So that's really the tensions when we talk about it, and I hear it on both sides, and, you know, we're going to details to what some of the solutions are on the table. You know, you hear this $100 billion promise that's been made over the last decade. What is it? Where is it at? Why is it so important as we get into COP? But that's really, these are really the tensions and the theme, and you are seeing this divide between developed countries, developing countries, as we head into COP next week.
Fantastic, thank you. I mean, it's such a it's such a tough agenda to be dealing with, particularly while we're trying to build back better from COVID at the same time. So I think it would be good to transition at this point over to let's throw to Vivek first. So, you know, as Mick pointed out, Vivek, first of all, welcome. Could you share a little bit about your organization before we jump into the questions? And welcome to Clubhouse. This is your first time here, so we hope you enjoy the experience. You just there you go.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me, Andrea. And namaste, everybody. Great to be here. I had the privilege of being at that concert in Central Park in New York City, the Global Citizen Concert, a few weeks ago, and it was such a coming together and such a display of the human spirit after months and months of isolation because of the plague. And I'm trying to carry that spirit forward into the daunting challenges that Mick laid out well. I work with a group called Numathi, which we started about 10 years ago, and we focus on pursuing social and environmental justice by combining the power of law with the power of people. And we work deeply in 6 countries around the world, and we also convene something called the Legal Empowerment Network, which is a community of over 2,700 justice groups from just about everywhere on the planet who share that focus. And we are learning from each other to get better in our own places and coming together across our borders to advance a more just future.
Thank you, Vivek. I wish we had met that day at the conference. But so digging into a question for you, you know, as Mick mentioned, you know, we are also clinging to optimism here, but we just know it's also time that the truth is told, and, you know, the public knows what we're up against and how fast we need to move. So given the concerns that, you know, that the crisis is worsening and will definitely get worse if we don't act boldly now and thoughtfully, what are the solutions or factors that, you know, they may be overlooking at COP? So, you know, if financing these solutions is going to be a central focus this year, what are some of the investments in climate change activities that have failed or fallen short in the past? And what is your view for what's needed moving forward based on your experience?
Cool, Andrea. Yeah, I would add a dimension of injustice to the ones that Mick laid out. The ones Mick laid out are sort of between countries, you know, and he was rightly summarizing China and India, for example, say to the U.S., man, you got rich polluting. How are you going to put this on us now? And then in the U.S. says back, but the problem is so big, we're not going to be able to solve it without you. I would add another dimension of injustice, and it's one that actually, if you zoom in, you see across the hemispheres. It's a commonality, a common thread that you see in rich countries and poor countries alike. And that common thread is environmental injustice. No matter where you go, and I've been all over the place, environmental harms, including the ones that are warming the planet, they are concentrated in communities with less wealth and less power, communities that face discrimination. Here in the U.S., at the same time that the Build Back Better bill is being negotiated, at the same time that Secretary Kerry is flying to Scotland, President Biden has been approving new fossil fuel infrastructure, including the Line 3 pipeline through Minnesota that is supposed to transport 760,000 barrels of tar sands oil every day. and a massive expansion of oil drilling on the North Slope of Alaska. I actually got arrested last week in front of the White House, committing civil disobedience under the leadership of communities, indigenous communities, black communities across the United States who are resisting those climactically disastrous proposals. And it's a similar dynamic elsewhere. In India, which is where my family's from, this month, indigenous people from Hasdeo Arand, which is one of the most pristine forests left in India, in Chhattisgarh, they marched 300 kilometers to their state capital, Raipur, to oppose a project that Prime Minister Modi has approved, which would turn over 18,500 acres of forest to be destroyed to mine 900 million tons of coal. And so I think in order to find a pathway out of this deep existential predicament that we are in, I think it's crucial that we recognize that we can't solve this through technology alone or through top-down commitments by nation states alone. We need to confront the underlying injustice that makes the destruction possible.
Thank you, Vivek. And so, but can I push you a little bit further on that? So the ways in which I have seen from my work on the ground in India and Africa, some of the ways to combat justice is through organizing, through protesting, getting yourself arrested, through civil disobedience. But it's also, pushing for the very laws and accountability, mechanisms, policy with teeth, and then the will to enforce them. But what else would you say is needed to come out of COP in order to, how do things have to trickle down from COP into countries, into local cities, in order to deliver the justice that you are rightly calling for?
Yeah, I think we need to be working towards a part two of the Paris Accord, one that focuses less on the rights of nation states and more on the rights of communities. And these are principles of environmental justice that each of us should be fighting for in our own home places, and that we should also be coming together to fight for in kind of regional and global forums, so that we build new norms around environmental governance. And concretely, what I'm talking about, number one, is protect environmental defenders. The people like the ones I got arrested with last week, the ones from communities, almost always poor communities, indigenous communities, black communities, ones who are facing discrimination, they are the ones where the harms are concentrated. Like those tribal people from Chhattisgarh who were marching to Raipur earlier this month, these people, when they stand up to protect their own places and their own dignity, they are protecting all of us. And yet, instead of protecting them, we often allow them to get killed. Global Witness collects data on murders of environmental defenders. It was over 220 that were killed last year, and that number they have been tracking for the last decade has been going up every year. So number one is we need a legal regime that actually protects environmental defenders. We have protections for witnesses in criminal cases, for example, or corporate whistleblowers. Like if you're on the inside and you blow a whistle about a corporation, you get access to legal protection. But ordinary people who are standing in the way of climate disaster do not have protections like those. So that's one concrete principle. The second one is we should be granting every community the right to free, prior, informed consent over what's built on their territory. If the people in Alaska had that, if the people in Minnesota had that, where Line 3 is passing, we wouldn't be building that pipeline with Biden's approval. If the people in Chhattisgarh had true FPIC rights, free, prior, informed consent, Prime Minister Modi wouldn't be able to turn over 18,500 acres of forest for coal mining. And so that basic right of communities to make decisions about what happens in their place, it doesn't exist right now. We should be fighting for that. A third principle is to proactively invest in these specific communities that have borne the disproportionate burden of environmental harm, so that they can build resilience and they can accelerate the transition to a more sustainable way of life. And that is along the lines of sort of Green New Deal idea. We need a global Green New Deal, one that invests in communities that have been harmed, supports them to make these transitions that we need to do rapidly. And I would just flag that a good start in this direction is the Escazú Agreement. I don't know if folks on the line have heard of Escazú. It's the first international agreement to focus on environmental justice, and it came into force after like a decade of negotiations on Earth Day of this year. And it commits, the 12 or so countries that have adopted it, commit to some of the principles that I was just describing. And activists from the Latin America region, including members of the network that we convene from the Latin America region, they tell me that it's not just a piece of paper, that Escazú and the negotiations that have led to Escazú, they've offered genuine leverage for people at the front lines who are facing harm. And so I would love to see, and we are working like hell to try to build a stronger, more connected grassroots movement for environmental justice, where people are pushing back against the destruction where it's happening. And we are proactively pushing for a new form of environmental governance that adopts some of the principles that I just mentioned, both in our own places, you know, here, say, Washington, D.C., where I live, the Mid-Atlantic region of the United States, Chhattisgarh, Sierra Leone, wherever we live, and then also building towards norms and principles that we agree on globally.
Thank you. I think I'd like to invite you back to do a deep dive on some of these useful case studies where things have worked, or the useful models that we can maybe share a further light on in a deeper dive conversation with folks on the platform at some point in the future. So thank you for that. So
thank you, Andrea, for having me, and I'm yours. We do actually. It's a daunting crisis, but we do have serious wins to celebrate and to learn from. So happy to dive into those in the future.
We do. We definitely have big wins. Money is starting to move. The world does seem to be waking up. I'm not so sure about Washington. I'm going to remain hopeful and not, you know, kind of go on endlessly about that in this room, because we want to hear everybody else's voice. But along the lines of your work in grassroots protection, Vivek, I just want to ask if you're working with and or empowering the youth, particularly in the South, who will be bearing the brunt of a lot of this if we kind of adults don't get it together now, and if they're being equipped with the tools to continue to, you know how to lobby and pressure and hold government to account. Are you working with young people in your movement?
Absolutely, yeah. Some of the most visionary and courageous people in our global community are young, and they see that the older generations have not taken care of things for them, and that they are going to be responsible for carrying us forward. And yet, one of the things that we're really excited about is the way in which young people who have been activated, who are motivated, are adopting some of these concrete tools of how you can use law, how you can use organizing to actually get concrete solutions.
Fantastic. I have a network of child protection, legal rights activists and advocates and lawyers to connect you to. So with that, I'd like to first to just acknowledge two other Global Citizen members of the team in the audience, Julia Freifield, and I hope I pronounced that correctly, Julia, and Mara Ranville, who was a partner in crime and making this room happen and the entire series. So I just want to acknowledge them. Everybody give them a follow. Please give everybody a follow up on the stage. And with that, I'd like to introduce Paresh, if you could share briefly about the work that you're working on before we get into the questions that we'll be discussing around climate justice. Welcome. I don't think this is your first Clubhouse room, but welcome to the stage. If you tap the microphone in the bottom right-hand corner of the phone, you can unmute. Great. Welcome.
Thank you, Andrea. Thank you all, actually, for having me. I am here in Houston, the energy capital of the world, as we say, but we're rebranding ourselves to call ourselves the energy transition capital of the world now. I am a startup founder. E-Squared Equitable Energy is a pre-launch platform to engage consumers to compensate for their Scope 3 energy-related emissions in support of energy access projects in public countries. But well before that, going back to the MDGs in 2000, I had been advocating for the inclusion of energy poverty on the global agenda when especially the MDGs missed out on including them among the 8 goals. Certainly that was then corrected about 15 years later, and so now we have the UN SDGs, including SDG 7, calling for universal access to affordable, reliable, modern, sustainable energy. So I also had the privilege of working with Mick and the GC team for Global Citizen Live, as you mentioned. I had the joy of being present as well in Central Park. The spirit of hope and energy was really palpable. I'm still kind of feeding off of it. I'd like to say that the connection between artists and audience is kind of where the magic happens, where I think inspiration really kind of stirs us to activism. So, you know, a huge fan of what Global Citizen is doing to inspire the masses, if you will, to action. So, you know, I wanted to just kind of talk about, I guess, energy poverty. Andrea, if you wanted to maybe direct me.
Sure, I will pivot. Yeah, sure. So we were, you know, prepping for this, and by exchange, we were talking about the nexus between climate action and energy, and we've framed how the Global North has used between 80 to 90% of the carbon budget, based, as Mick was alluding to earlier, developing their economies on fossil fuels, and now the global, they're, you know, everyone's like, okay, you can pivot to a fast transition, Global South. Now you can follow a low carbon pathway. Easier said than done. There's a lack of access to affordable, reliable, and sustainable and modern energy, and that all falls under, as you mentioned, Paresh, UN SDG 7. And this reinforces the cycle of poverty, because energy poverty impacts so many aspects of people's lives, from being able to plant and harvest crops, droughts, you know, severe weather, quality of the soil, and, you know, able to put food on the table for families and villages, and, you know, whether kids have access to electricity to do homework can actually impact parents' decisions on whether to send them to school. And ultimately, sadly, statistics show that that impacts girls disproportionately more often than not. And once a girl, and we know with COVID, this is exacerbated because lots of kids have been had to stay home to care for family members, or kind of fell out of school and back into child labor, which is a key driver of poverty. So it's all interconnected. And so, you know, there's also the use, the health impacts of using cook stoves, and the terrible impact that has across the developing world on many families' lives. And then, of course, there's the lack of a electricity and digital divide, which impacts access to information. So, Paresh, how can climate finance activate to, you know, kind of, if we miss the intersectionality of this point in time without building in solutions that are savvy and cut across many of these issues, like the solar lights or the solar cook stoves, how can, you know, we will really be missing the pathway for our collective future. So how can climate finance advance access to clean energy and justice?
Yeah, no, thank you for setting that up. I think you've captured most all the points that I would address. To start with, I sort of liken energy poverty to it being a kind of a prison sentence, you know, that arrests human development, an unfreedom, if you will. And, you know, we here in Houston say that finance is the lifeblood of energy. I would take it further and say that energy is the lifeblood of our society. You know, it's a fundamental as access to clean water, air, food, shelter, a basic necessity, really, to fulfill and realize the human potential. So when we speak of climate finance and climate justice, clean and affordable energy really is foundational to that, to a just, inclusive, equitable, sustainable
economic future. And we have the sort of technological advances today, things like solar mini grids, for example, clean cook stoves, solar home systems, solar lanterns. In short, the pursuit of a net zero transition really can deliver this access, universal access to energy that we lack today, while creating rewarding green jobs. But this calls for really climate finance to give SDG 7 top priority, and closing this chronic gap that we have seen over the past 7 years in funding to reach universal energy access by 2030. So, you know, for those who are unacquainted, let me just kind of dimension what energy poverty looks like. Today, we count about 760 million people without access to electricity. We measured that by new metric, the modern energy minimum, which puts it at about 1,000 kilowatt hours per person per year. That number actually rises to 3.6 billion, right? So those are underserved or folks that have unreliable access to energy. For perspective, 1,000 kilowatt hours is about as much as a large refrigerator might use in a year. Or compare that to the U.S. per capita energy consumption at around about 11,000 kilowatt hours per year. So it's not a whole lot, really, when we say 1,000 kilowatt hours. But it's the modern minimum for a low middle income country. So in addition to that, there are about 2.6 billion lacking access to clean cooking facilities. That's folks who cook with open furnaces using firewood, charcoal, kerosene stovetops, as you mentioned. And that disproportionately affects women and children, resulting in about 4 million premature deaths annually caused by exposure to indoor air pollution. So, you know, on the point of historical emissions, you know, it's already been made, right, that the OECD countries have polluted, their way to prosperity. And now we're kind of asking for developing countries who are facing their own growth imperatives, especially in the wake of COVID, to go kind of on a energy diet. That, I think, is climate injustice in my mind. And so, you know, if I were to say, how important is energy access or energy poverty? It is really the linchpin, the primary lever to achieving all the other UN SDGs, the Paris Agreement, and indeed, we cannot end extreme poverty without ending energy poverty. So consumers here, I want to mention real quick, have an important role to play in the spirit of global citizen that summons, citizens to actually take actions. The global north, we have really, it's incumbent upon us to take responsible actions to balance this inequity that I mentioned, right? And the IEA's 2050 net zero roadmap estimates that about 55% of the cumulative emissions reductions in that pathway are linked to consumer choices. So we have a lot to live up to here, in the global north. Just kind of an illustrative point, video gamers in California annually use more energy than entire countries. Think about that.
That is pretty, yeah, that's staggering actually, and sad.
One of the things I take from, just what Paresh is saying is, it's very important that in addressing climate change, we don't set up a zero-sum game in which essentially our solutions to this catastrophic climate challenge basically end up baking in the inequities and poverty that we have, both between and within countries, to Vivek's point. And so, as we, get set to go to COP, as we get set to, make the concessions needed, make the accommodations needed, the investments needed, it's really important energy poverty itself isn't traded away, because I agree with Paresh, to do so would be an injustice. And, for me, the most vivid analogy of trying to understand, if you're a leader of one of these communities or countries, and you're being tasked to sort of make these commitments, adapt to the impact of climate change, transition your economy to a net zero one, while at the same time also not slow down, your own development and lifting people out of poverty, you know, and the best analogy, it was actually something I read actually back in 2009 in the lead up to the Copenhagen COP. It was a book by Tom Friedman, the commentator, and he had released a book that year called Hot, Flat, and Crowded. And in that book, he says, you know, if you're one of these such leaders, he said, you're essentially like the bus driver in the movie Speed. I don't know if many of you saw that movie Speed. It came out, I think, in the early 90s. And the premise
Sandra Bullock.
Exactly. And the premise is they're on the bus, and, you know, there's a bomb on the bus, and they can't slow down. And if they brake or slow down beyond a certain speed, the bus is going to blow up. So they've got to keep going, right? And that's essentially what he was using to describe, if you're a leader in one of these communities, that is the tension, right? Many of these leaders and others are elected to put food on the table. They're elected to meet essential needs. And you can't slow that down. And if you do, that could lead to upheaval, you know, all sorts of others, like it could tear up the very fabric of your communities, right? If you trade away those needs. But at the same time, he says, okay, so you're driving that bus and you've got to somehow, this is the additional thing, change the engine of the bus without slowing down. that's the challenge.
And,
you've got to keep
and defuse the bomb down. And defuse the bomb at the same time.
Exactly, and change the energy, put in the engine, put in a clean one, exactly. And so I do really, you know, it's something because we as activists, and, you know, it's funny because we talk about tensions amongst countries. You know, I've seen tensions amongst the development community and the climate community for this reason. And one of our big, you know, challenges at Global Citizen is how do we bring this together and address these solutions in a way which is just. And I do ultimately believe, and it comes back to what Paresh was saying, is that those that have benefited the most and used up most of the carbon budget, right, that we're allowed to, should be, you know, facilitating or contributing a proportionate part of the burden, right, to help these communities both mitigate and adapt to the impact of climate change. And that's really at the heart of it. And then you get into... Yeah, I guess the next question is, and I'll shut up here, throw it back to you, Andrea, and then the question is okay, well, what then are the right solutions, both at the local, national, and global level, to facilitate this transition?
Absolutely. So we have government, you know, national level cooperation and the pay-fors, who pays how much, and we're saying that the countries that have contributed, the largest emitters and the most developed economies should be paying the fair share of that amount to make that happen. But we're also hearing, you know, that I would shout out what Paresh said, which is, you know, these are also matters of, it's not just financing, it's national security issues for countries, which makes the debate even trickier. But it climate change this morning again hit the headlines. The U.S. administration, you know, calling it, putting climate change as top of a national security issue. So energy security goes along with that. And then, but what Vivek is saying as well is that it's we have to look at not just these trans, you know, national agreements and this global cooperation, which is absolutely critical at this point in time, but we have to look at what's happening on the ground, where this money is going, how it's getting deployed. Is it going to create new jobs for people that need them? Will they get the training they need? Will it go into investing in women? And will there be adequate protection and laws to ensure that their rights are protected? Because without these laws, there will be no teeth to kind of oversee these investments, and also protections for whistleblowers. So with that, and then, of course, let's not forget the artists to keep us hopeful, the music, the celebration of the wins. Ford Foundation just announced that it's divesting from fossil fuels. I think Paresh had many exciting things to announce, that the Rockefeller Foundation and IKEA Foundation have launched a new platform platform at COP, or will launch, called the Global Energy Alliance for People and Planet. You heard it here first, or maybe you didn't. I don't know, a catalytic 1 billion vehicle to scale energy access for 1 billion people while reducing 1 billion tons of GHG emissions. I love it. And then Larry Fink has proposed $100 billion a year in government grants, subsidies to de-risk carbon projects in developing countries. That in turn would stimulate $1 trillion a year in institutional investments. So, you know, the money is great. We just need to make sure it gets to the right place and that people are protected in the process. So with that, sorry, Mick, did you want to jump in before I throw to Mamandwe?
No, I just also, because, you know, I just didn't get a chance to touch on what Vivek said. And, you know, that you just reminded me when you were talking about, okay, how do we actually facilitate this and hold these groups accountable and the different levers that we can pull on in our communities. And, you know, that the importance of that civic space, I mean, I wouldn't underestimate just how important that is and how just under threat more than anything else right now, civic space is, you know, it's insidious what's going on. It's under threat. You know, yesterday we just, you know, announced our win in the Australian government against their attempts using tax law to muffle charities effectively. But we're seeing this right around the world. And it was telling that, you know, I was doing an interview as part of Global Citizen Live on CNN into India, and it was in part about climate change and these dynamics that was going on. And Vivek alluded to some of the local issues. And I always, whenever I do these things in different countries, I always like to cite local activists or, you know, find out what their demands are, to cite them and you know, to stand in solidarity and amplify what they want, their demands, and push people to support them. And it was very alarming that, you know, the communities I spoke to, you know, the data they were given, Talia on our team, that I could cite, they were very clear that they didn't want to be named. They didn't want to be mentioned. They wanted to keep it very general because they were afraid. And I think this is happening right around the world, this clampdown. And it's shocking that even at the COP, you know, there's activists for whatever reason that can't get in from the Pacific Islands and others, you know, the worst affected communities. And I think it's incumbent on those of us who are privileged to be able to speak out, like those of us at Global Citizen or Paresh, who does work with the Asia Society, you know, that we don't just call for specific policy asks, you know, but as part of the solution, we also call out and defend that civic space as well. And so, you know, it was interesting because we went through this ourselves. I mentioned this case in Australia recently where we took the government effectively to court, but it got me thinking, well, we fortunately had pro bono legal advocates willing to do that. We had resources. Others don't have that. And how can we be a source, even on our social media, to defend that space? And I think, you know, it's something that Aaron actually said, I think last week or before, on one of these clubhouses, that it comes back to the whole idea that there are multiple battles going on. And we can't fight all but every battle at the same time and at once, but we can all contribute and support one another's battles when it gets to a critical point, no matter what our issues are. And I think that is equally applicable to the fight for activism itself, and to make sure we have the ability to contribute to public debate.
And Mick, yes, absolutely. And building on what you're saying and what Vivek was saying, this is... this civic space is absolutely key to democracy you know, the protection of human rights. So this is a key component, you know, that a key focus that also the media could be evolving and, you know, putting pressure on the media to cover these stories in a more comprehensive way. But, you know, the trick is to ensure the protection on the ground as well. So I'd say that in the round two that Vivek is proposing in terms of the monitoring and the watchdog or the follow-up of the Paris Accord agreements and COP26 is going to be key, and a human rights and justice component runs throughout. So that was an excellent point. And as Aaron did mention in these other rooms, we have definitely called. I recently had the great opportunity to meet somebody from the Women's March movement and have had the encounter with some folks from the movement from Black Lives and also youth movements around the world that I've connected with, where we have simultaneously said, why are we not, you know, uniting these movements strategically? It can be challenging at times because you have, you know, your base and you have your issue, but maybe sometimes putting your heads together to strategize and ask and weigh in at key moments, like you said, could help push the agenda over, or, you know, keep the eyes on our leaders to hold them to account. And it's not just the governments, it's the businesses as well, Mick and Vivek and Paresh, because there's also not just what they're saying, all these wonderful commitments, they're important and they're fantastic. Google just came out in support of the Build Back Better Act and with climate provisions, but you have to watch end-to-end systematic thinking, because one minute they're funding, you know, trade organizations that are working against the bill. So we have to look end to end, and globally, consumers need to be educated and step up. Mindy Luber from Ceres had said that one thing is missing in the world is a massive global consumer movement to hold governments, businesses to account, if governments kind of aren't acting fast enough, if the political machinery doesn't allow governments to act quickly enough. Paresh, you unmiked, sorry. And then we must go to Mwandwe after.
Yes, just very quickly to Mick's point, I agree that we have to defend the public square. You know, just bringing it home here to Houston, even just a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, we couldn't use the word climate change in the energy sector here, or in the largest of business convenings and chambers. But now we're able to talk about climate change, and to Vivek's point, environmental justice as well. In fact, we've got the grandfather of environmental justice, Professor Robert Bullard at TSU right here in Houston, who's now actually working with the incumbent energy sector. And so, you know, we're taking kind of our incumbency problem and turning it into our incumbency advantage, if you will. But very quickly, I want to make just one quick point about the financing outcomes that I'd like to see at COP26. So, you know, we have to, I think, get the mix right as to where that $100 billion commitment is dispersed. I would call that simply just a down payment, right? It's a confidence-building measure to build trust, but we will really need trillions of dollars to meet the climate mitigation, adaptation, and justice outcomes. And I would rather, as a former banker, want to pursue not just commitments, but rather, you know, get in the check cashing business, if you will, because that really is where the proof is going to be, is how we translate those payments into actually hard cash dollars. So, you know, to meet the universal access to energy goal by 2030, here's what we need: $41 billion annually for access to electricity, $4.5 billion annually to meet universal clean cooking. We've got much ground to make up at COP26. In 2019, we saw a decline of 27%. That's well before COVID-19. And that number is going to decline even further in terms of energy access investments in 2020 and 2021. So we need more innovative mechanisms and models like Global Energy Alliance, the platform that Rockefeller will launch with IKEA Foundation at COP. And also what Larry Fink has proposed. Take a look at his op-ed in the New York Times. It was just a few days ago that he shared his plan on that. So, you know, I'll close on this point by saying that, you know, we've got to have creative approaches to climate finance and energy access. And I hope to see some of these new mechanisms, you know, forced at COP26 and in the weeks and months to follow.
Well, and hopefully we will report out live as commitments and announcements are being made from on the ground at COP. And also, you know, it may take sadly, another deep dive to kind of break down a little bit more detail, you know, what exactly this financing structure looks like. You know, is it, government, it sits with governments, it's allocated to private institutions, it sits with the World Bank. Does any of it trickle down to the local government? You know, I mean, just knowing where those pots of money sit and how people can track it and access it is also quite, you know, interesting. How much of it is with government, with the private sector investors, and how much of it is going into micro grants to support entrepreneurs and people so they can put food on the table and get the training they need. But speaking of, sorry, Paresh, go ahead.
No, not at all. I would say that, yes, some of the funding, the $100 billion commitment, needs to really be, I think, channeled in a catalytic way, in the sense that it has to unlock the real money, really, that is in capital markets, in institutional investors, large pools of capital that are looking for investments that deliver on impact, but also the bottom line, right? Double or triple bottom line, as they say.
And I have one last question for you, Paresh, which is, are there any kind of, this may be for the next room, but are there any innovative financing schemes that are, where money could be invested in a way that incentivizes good behavior and de-incentivizes negative behavior and maybe even pits, you know, businesses or, people who aren't living up to climate standards or pollution or whatever the regulations are that we impose to stay, you know, get to net zero. Are there innovative financing mechanisms like that that are being developed, you know, by, I don't know, hedge fund, VCs, private equity, sovereign wealth funds?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. There are new sustainable finance instruments that are becoming increasingly the norm. To norm, like green bonds, sustainability linked bonds and credit facilities. So those are self-regulated or selected, if you will, by the issuer, the company, where if they reach certain self-identified KPIs or metrics, whether it's reduction in their operational emissions, their borrowing costs decline, right, go down. If they don't, then the yields go up. So there are ways to the ESG movement especially put that sort of a lens on lending and borrowing. If you look at even performance-based instruments, social bonds, environmental impact bonds, these are the kinds of new instruments that increasingly I will see issued in larger and larger volumes. But the velocity has to increase, right? We don't see those issuances here in Houston, for example. Not a single green bond issuance in the energy gap of the world. We need to rapidly decarbonize, you know, the incumbent legacy energy system. So I'm hopeful. I think bankers will chase those deals because they see now that they're generating more fees in issuing those kinds of instruments than, in fact, a vanilla variety type of lending to hydrocarbons.
Well, thank you. So I'm hearing that we need money invested in a way that unlocks additional funds, so it's a multiplier effect and with leverage. But at the same time, I shout out with caution, we need, you know, social protection floors and social protection funds, which may not be about, you know, which may not have the multiplying impact you're talking about, but are put in place, you know, like a universal child benefit to protect poor families and particularly women and children. But with that, I'd like to finally welcome Mo Wandwe into the conversation, and thank you so much, and apologies for keeping you waiting so long. I think we should pivot back to the focus on food security and how climate change is going to, or is currently impacting our food security and food systems, and who that impacts the most. And so, Mwandwe, could you kindly introduce yourself and your role and share your perspective on this and what you would like to see come out of these global convenings?
Thanks, Andrea, and hi, everybody. My name is Mwandwe Chileshe, and I work on our food security and culture nutrition work at Global Citizen. This has been a very interesting conversation to follow along to. I want to bring it to sort of this crisis that is happening alongside the climate crisis, and that is the hunger crisis that's happening. Right now, there's close to 42 million people on the brink of starvation. And the reason I mention this is if we look at countries like Madagascar, it's estimated that around 30,000 people there are already facing starvation and unable to get meals. And all of that is induced by climate change. They've had four seasons without rain and some of the longest, driest spells that they've seen. So it really shows the sort of impact that it's having on communities. And speaking about the people, I think a lot of the speakers today have talked about this. The people who have contributed the least to climate change are the ones who are faced with the greatest threats. And so it's really rural communities and smallholder farmers. I want to share this bit of a story. Last week, I was out in small rural farms across Zambia, where I currently am, and met with a lot of female farmers. And a lot of what we've talked about today, it's communities who do not have access to any kind of energy, so are cooking with firewood or charcoal, but also communities who are very much dependent on the environment around them. So it's small farming communities. And a lot of these women, I think the number one thing that you don't anticipate when you hear climate change is sort of the dignity that it takes away from people, in that people, when they can't get the same amount of food that they were able to from their lands previously, what it is that they have to do, the kind of extra work that they have to get into, the manual labor that they do. A lot of the women I spoke to, as a result, have gotten into charcoal producing. So we see also a cycle that ends up being repeated. This issue on sort of climate justice is really about these rural communities, women and children. Water is now more scarce in their communities. They're spending time after school going out to search for more water. But it's also these female farmers who don't have, who already didn't have access to resources and whose lives have only become harder. If I should mention, only about $1 out of every $10 of climate finance goes to local level climate action. And so locally shaped climate solutions are being passed over by global responses to the climate crisis. And so if you were to ask me what I want to see come out of Glasgow, it's really, we need to be able to fill the $10 billion funding gap to meet the $100 billion promise to help poorer countries. But we must also help build the resilience, incomes, and food security of the world's 3.4 billion rural people. I think Glasgow is an opportunity to ensure both commitments to mitigating climate change, but also ensuring communities who are already facing its impact are able to adapt. And so a just climate transition will ensure that we reduce structural injustices in society, such as the exclusion of marginalized groups from decision-making, but also ensuring that the women that I've talked about, who are the smallholder farmers, are able to access these resources that are going towards climate finance.
Thank you, Mwandwe. Mick, I just want to invite you back. I'm conscious of the time. We have about 15 more minutes, and I'd love to drill down a bit more on what Mwandwe was saying, because it's so, and also the picture that she's painting of the, you know, life on the ground, for example, in rural Africa, is riveting, and, you know, maybe hard for some of us to imagine if you've not been out there. We have friends in the audience who live in Africa. Ben, I see you down there. I'd love to have you come up in a moment. But Mick, I'd like to pass to you to jump in and reframe or ask some additional questions.
Yeah, and it's something both Mwandwe and Paresh mentioned. They both referred to, in essence, as climate finance and all this $100 billion. And I just want to provide some context on that, because ultimately we know there are both, there's both support countries need, like to change different types of energy, have the energy transition, and to receive financial support. And there is also the very real impacts that are happening. Mwandwe spoke about what was happening, for instance, in Madagascar. Much of that is now cited to be in effect because of the causes from climate change.
And so clearly, you know, this amount has to do a lot of things, which is why, you know, you hear people say it's got to both 50% needs to go to mitigation, 50% needs to go to adaptation. But the important thing to recognize is the whole point of this, when it was set up, you know, in 2009, recognizing the historic responsibility of developed countries and the lopsided impact of climate change and the need to address it now. The whole idea was, you know, to get to $100 billion a year. So we're not talking about $100 billion just as a once-off payment. We're talking about this was something which they would agree to provide collectively and to get to, by 2020, $100 billion a year. Now, we didn't get there at the end of last year. And now going into COP, there is this huge desire to try and get to $100 billion. And many have called this as a red line. You know, we've spoken about the lack of trust, the lack of goodwill. Many have said, you know, just for developing countries to know that these negotiations are being had in good faith, you know, this is a red line which they expect even going in. This is the entry point to have negotiation, is for this $100 billion pledge to be met. But a couple of points, you know, even, and I think we've got the shortfall is about $15 billion, $10 to $15 billion that need to be pledged over the next week. And there's a couple who haven't yet pledged, like Italy. Italy actually did say, as part of Global Citizen Live, they would bring a big pledge. But the important thing is, you know, even if they get to $100 billion, that's not $100 billion right here and right now. This just means there's commitments in place to get us to $100 billion by, I think, 2024, right? So, you know, President Biden's pledge that he made at the UN General Assembly to double climate financing, you know, that's by 2024, that scale up. And that's assuming Congress agrees to it and actually gives him the funds to meet that pledge, and then assuming a president doesn't just come along in 2025 and just, you know, throw it all away. So right now there is really two big debates going on. There's how do we close the gap to $100 billion? But now there is this second question that developing countries have put on the agenda and said, well, really, yes, okay, you might get to 2024, but we shouldn't look at this $100 billion, you know, as, you know, basically an aspiration. We should look at it as a promise and basically say, for every year that the $100 billion wasn't met, from starting from 2020, so 5 years effectively, you know, that money should be made up. And so this ask of $100 billion a year is effectively $500 billion over the next 5 years is what they're asking for. So they're saying, look, get to $100 billion, that's fine, but we want you to pledge $500 billion in total and make up and provide compensation for any dollars that don't have coming through. Now, you can imagine that this has now become, you know, and there was media about it this morning from the U.S. side, because the U.S. is saying, oh, this is not a legal point, this is not a contract, this was an aspirational target. But the point is we've got to where we are, where relations are so tense and there's such a lack of trust and belief in these promises that they're saying, unless we get some kind of concrete pledge, it's impossible. Like, how do you expect us to bring these commitments and take it back to our constituencies if you haven't come through? And, you know, you can look at it both lens. Ultimately, this is not a legal argument, it's a political argument. And it's about, to Paresh's point, just a down payment to provide the goodwill and responsibility and to live up to responsibility and provide that trust. And ultimately, you know, even $500 billion over 5 years, you know, the U.S. is set to spend $700 billion on its military next year alone. And as you pointed out, Andrea, you know, this is one of the biggest threats according to the military planners. And so, you know, this is where we're at. We've got these, in effect, 10 days. But, you know, the U.S. obviously makes up a big chunk of this $100 billion. And people are just saying, why? if Biden, you know, he puts a portrait of FDR in the Oval Office, he wants to be this transformational president. People have spoken about a global Green Deal. If he wants to be the leader on climate change, show America his back, go in there next week with the other developed countries and say, yep, we will pledge to deliver $500 billion over the next 5 years, and we collectively will deliver that money. And I think anything short of that, it's going to be hard to get any breakthroughs on all the other areas we care about. So that's really where we're at and what we're talking about. And you'd expect to hear a lot of commentary. Because as Mwandwe says, like, you know, there isn't enough funding, and Paresh said the funding has actually reduced over the last 2 years. So we definitely need some sort of shakeup. It's expected over the coming week.
Well, I mean, this is going to be riveting. I mean, I can't tell. It's like I've been wondering whether Biden shouldn't even be getting on the plane, as important as this is. But in a way, it feels like I'm still trying to be hopeful. But if we can't get, so we need to get movement in Washington, because I feel if we don't kind of deliver right now, it's almost, you know, it'll be like, okay, we rejoined the Paris Agreement, but, you know, we need to put our money where our mouth is and drive change at home, because especially since we're the second biggest emitter. So it's going to be, I feel like this is high level drama that's playing out, although it's not that funny because it's people's, you know, as we've seen with COVID, it's many people's lives are at stake. But I am inspired, you know, by the good news of the things that we do here happening, and through the festivals and, you know, with the Global Citizen puts on and the artists and the music. But we definitely have a lot of work to do. And so, you know, I would urge everybody to follow Global Citizen, look at the pledges and sign the petitions, follow Mick and Aaron, follow everyone here on the stage. Write, you know, to world leaders. Maybe we should put a resist bot together that, you know, tweet out all the key leaders who are holding back on their commitments. Tweet Biden, remind him, call every stakeholder you have in your network to try to put pressure on this. And then we will hopefully continue to report out live from the scenes on what's happening there. But I'd like to invite questions from anybody in the audience. We have only a few minutes left, but Ben is, I think, in Arizona right now, but he lives in Ouagadougou in West Africa. His wife is from Brazil. Ben, would you like to ask a question or make a comment for anyone in the crowd? Or, sorry, on the stage, forgive me.
Well, first, I want to say hi, and as always, you're doing amazing rooms and creating action, which is important. We talk a lot, but we really need to be doing stuff. In Burkina, and we've been there for almost a year now, and I am still in Arizona, but it's been interesting. But because when I first got there, I met the guy who's actually in charge of the Millennium Challenge Corp. Fund, which is like $500 million. It's one of the largest funds, and set up completely for supporting and developing infrastructure, both energy and water. And the guy who's in charge of it is very, I mean, every he comes from you know, the conservation side. So he was sort of biting his lip for 2 years while Trump was around, and they really couldn't do anything. But they are pushing to do a large solar project in the area and use that as an example for the region. So there is some interesting stuff happening, with the caveat being sorts of problems.
So, I think your audio is cutting out, Ben. Sorry. Yeah, I think we're losing you. If it, yeah,
oh, shoot.
It's all right. I'm gonna. Sorry, I just muted you. Forgive me for. I think, but we lost your audio. But I was keen to bring in your perspective from Ouagadougou. Also, was as someone who spent a lot of time in Brazil. So you're perspective from the ground. But with that, and given that we're reaching 2:15, I'd like to throw back for any last comments. Maybe we could go round robin around the room, and from Mick or Aaron, if you'd like to jump in at this point, and then Mwandwe, Paresh, and Vivek, and we can close out the room.
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in, Andrea. Thank you, everyone, Vivek, Paresh, everyone who's spoken one way. Great discussion. I have certainly learned a lot, and actually my dread is rising as much as my hope is hopefully still alive. I mean, the numbers that we're talking about here are so huge, and it's worth bearing in mind, bringing it back to investments in environmental justice, that the investments there are still so underwhelming. You know, of the Great American Recovery Plan passed earlier this year, $1.9 trillion. There's $100 million set aside for environmental justice in the U.S. Huge, huge. So not enough. What resonates with me is Vivek's point of when we think about adaptation, and as Nick so rightly pointed out early on, as developing countries are going to the COP, expecting fulfillment of promises, not just of you need to help us adapt, but this needs to be a cooperative endeavor together if we're going to overcome that. So too, that's happening internally in countries with marginalized communities who need to be invested in order to get ready for the adaptation of the future. And I feel like people are ready for it. Certainly our global citizens are ready for it. They just need that guidance, and we need that investment. You know, legal empowerment is an amazing tool to enable people to be ready for the conversations that are going to come in terms of how do we use the land, how do we adapt at the community level to the inevitability that we're going to face. You know, I think it's important to realize we're heading into the COP here talking about 1.5 degrees as catastrophic for those of us who are okay right now. But as Mwandwe pointed out, and as we know, there are people who are suffering already from the effects of climate change, and that will definitely be affected regardless of the big changes that happen at the COP in the coming years because of the choices that we've made already. So we need to, just as in this pandemic, have had to adjust our lives, and for good or ill, most people have been able to adjust to a new reality. So too, we're going to have to do that in the face of climate change, and that requires investment. So, you know, the People's Adaptation Summit, I'm all for it. That needs to be a follow-up to COP. How do we ensure that both developed and developing countries, whatever big numbers they agree, ensure that a good chunk of that is going into the community level to prepare people for the future and to be able to address the impacts that we're seeing already. So, you know, I found this conversation very inspiring. There needs to be some big change. I hope that the COP is a turning point, but it has to, I mean, it's not going to be the end all. We have to continue to fight on this issue at the local level.
Yes, we have to look to ourselves and private citizens and private business and anyone we can get involved. Mick, over to you.
Well, I'm kind of happy, Mwandwe, you know, to throw it to you for the last word.
Great.
Because, you know, we had this meeting last week hosted with the Ban Ki-moon Center, and Ban Ki-moon is actually, you know, obviously, if there is a father of the Paris Agreement, he's probably as close to it as anyone. And he's really said, you know, looking at these communities, looking at farmers on the front lines, you know, this really is the test for sustainable development and the whole idea of leaving no one behind if we get this right. And, you know, Mwandwe is in the throes of this every day, and we're all, you know, campaigning, you know, for the G20, going to countries, going to others, going to try and get them to shake out more funds, more commitments. But, you know, she sees the impact of this, you know, on the ground and in communities. And so, Mwandwe, I'm happy if you want to take the final word from a global citizen standpoint on why this is so important right now.
Thanks, Meg. And I think what I want to sort of close out on is this issue on trust. Part of the reason why we need to see these big investments and commitments from countries who have done the most in contributing to the climate changes, we won't be able to get other countries and developing countries on board if they're seeing the majority of the population already going through a hunger crisis. Every day, I don't have power for about 3 to 4 hours. And this is because we have to manage sort of the energy in the country in terms of how it's distributed. And a lot of that is because we rely on water energy. So it's issues around countries and people who are already facing the impact of this won't be able to trust that this is a process that is just and fair to everybody if we don't see countries like the US and others taking the leadership and really putting the steps forward to ensure that this happens. I know there's an adaptation day happening at COP26, and I think that would be also be an important day to be able to highlight some of the things that we've talked about here today, and that includes smallholder farmers, like Mick said. It includes agriculture adaptation. It includes talking about resilience for rural communities. I just want to end on that word around these commitments are important in building trust.
Building trust and saving lives. Thank you, Mwandwe. Paresh and Vivek, your closing thoughts, and then we can wrap.
Yeah, just a really enriching, fruitful conversation. Really appreciated your perspectives, Vivek, Mwandwe, Mick, of course, Aaron, brought to the table today. I would simply close by saying that I want to see checks cashed from COP26 and beyond. And so, you know, all power to Mick and the Global Citizen team as they go to G20 and to Glasgow, you know, to really wrangle some commitments beyond just as we discussed today, the 100 billion. I think we need to see more flowing in sort of where I sit for energy access. This is the decade of action. We've got till 2030. We're behind. We've made some great strides over the past 15 odd years in reducing energy poverty, but we've got, again, some ground to make up since the pandemic hit us. So hopeful, but I'm going to want to see the proof at the end of all the pageantry in Glasgow.
Excellent. Checks cashed. That's the bottom line. Thank you. Thank you, Paresh. And Vivek, your last thoughts.
Hey, yeah, I'll close with a plug for a specific place to cash a check, which is the thing that we launched at the Global Citizen Concert in Central Park is something called the Legal Empowerment Fund, which is for the first time a multi-donor, multi-year fund dedicated to supporting grassroots justice work, supporting the work of communities who are at the front lines of this crisis, who are fighting new fossil fuel projects, who are fighting deforestation, or communities like the ones that Mwandwe described, who are fighting to adapt and build resilience and protect themselves in light of the changes that are happening. The goal for the fund is 100 million. We've raised out of 120 so far. And so that remainder 80 million would be a game changer for our field, because this work has been systematically under-resourced forever. But on the other hand, it would be a drop in the bucket for the kinds of financing that's being talked about at COP. And so that's my plug, is let's put a drop of the money that we're talking about into justice, into the efforts of communities to protect themselves, to exercise their own rights. When they are able to do that, they end up protecting all of us. We all benefit.
And I will just add a final thought, which is that I agree with everything that everybody said, and I would put into that justice bucket also protection for vulnerable women and children in particular, the social protection floors, and how we can have that link alongside this climate finance or to make sure that we are protecting the most vulnerable in the process. So with that, I just want to say thank you very much to everybody here on stage and to the folks who listened. We've recorded this and we'll share that out right away. And to Mara and the whole Global Citizen team, and Mwandwe especially, for her riveting description of life on the ground and the challenges facing these families and these farmers and why the action is so urgent. So follow Global Citizen, sign a petition, do whatever you can, invest, send money, donate, but, you know, raise your voice most importantly. Push the levers of your elected officials, vote, call on the U.S. to live up to its commitments, Biden to his campaign promises, and on global leaders to act boldly for climate and climate justice. So stay tuned for our fourth series, which will focus on the role of non-government actors next Thursday, same time, 1 o'clock p.m. To 2:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and also for some live reporting, hopefully from G20 and COP, to see how we are doing on progress. So thank you so much. It's a pleasure to meet everybody here on the stage. Thank you, Aaron, Mick, Mwandwe, Paresh, Vivek, and Ben for your thoughts, and Mara for helping pull this together. So with that, everybody stay safe, travel safely, and, you know, stay tuned, follow this issue. It's important.
Thanks, Andrea.
Thanks, Andrea. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. And we'll end the room in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.